Welcome to The Great Debate. I am Dr. Kim Kilby, Assistant Dean of Undergraduate Medical Education at Albany Medical College in Albany, New York, where I also practice clinically for the Bariatrics and Clinical Nutrition Group. I'm board certified in both family medicine and preventive medicine, and having worked for several years at the New York State Health Department before returning to the front lines of direct patient care, I know firsthand the need to enhance the synergy between public health and clinical medicine in order to meet the best health outcomes. I'm delighted to serve as your moderator tonight. Tonight's debate was organized by the enthusiastic efforts of our medical students at Albany Medical College. They would like to extend their appreciation to everyone at WAMC Northeast Public Radio and the Linden for helping to make this event possible. Our motion tonight is the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. This topic is not new to most of you listening, and it is likely no surprise to hear about the rising costs of healthcare for both providers and consumers. The United States is spending the highest GDP per capita on healthcare in the world, but still has lower measurable outcomes than many other countries. And yet, we still have many citizens who do not have health insurance or who remain underinsured. Healthcare reform has also been the source of much political controversy and has seen a lot of movement during the Obama administration, which began with the discussion of how to reduce the inflation of healthcare costs and ended with the passing of the Affordable Care Act. Implementation has been a challenge, with states refusing to comply and the bumpy launch of the Health Insurance Exchange website. But with the Affordable Care Act, reform is finally happening. Tonight, our debaters are going to help us explore the idea of whether or not a single-payer healthcare financing system is the actual reform needed to solve the health insurance, health quality, and health financing crises our country continues to face. Our debate tonight will follow a structured Oxford style and will be conducted in three rounds. The first portion will be the opening statements from each doctor, with time afterward for directed rebuttals. Then we will move into the audience question portion and end with closing statements from each side. Audience members, start thinking of your questions now as you listen to each side of the motion. So now that you know the format, let's get started. Again, our motion is the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. Now, let's meet the debater arguing for the motion. Dr. Paul Sung is a board-certified radiation oncologist and current faculty member of the Samuel Oshin Comprehensive Cancer Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California. He is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of doctors who advocate for a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health program. Dr. Sung received his medical degree from George Washington University and completed his residency at the University of Chicago Medical Center. He is the executive chairman of the Courage Campaign, a progressive California-based nonprofit whose mission is to defend and extend human rights through innovative leadership development training, strategic research, and public education. During the most recent health reform debate, he was a special medical contributor to CNN and appeared frequently on Larry King Live. In 2013, he was named by the California Insurance Commissioner as the very first visiting fellow in the California Department of Insurance working on healthcare policy. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sung. Now let's welcome our debater arguing against the motion, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Mitchell Heller. Dr. Heller is a board-certified emergency medicine physician and currently works at the JFK Medical Center in New Jersey. He is a member of the Benjamin Rush Society, a group of providers organized around the belief that the profession of medicine calls its practitioners to serve their patients rather than the government. Dr. Heller received his medicine degree from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and completed his residency at New York University Bellevue Hospital. Dr. Heller has published in several journals and has lectured at national emergency medicine meetings. Using an interdisciplinary approach, Dr. Heller has worked on various projects combining computer science and medicine relating to the development of screening protocols as well as optimizing efficiency in the emergency room. Dr. Heller debated last year at the University of Pennsylvania on the motion, maintenance of certification requirements fail to improve the quality of medical care while placing unnecessary burdens on physicians. Welcome, Dr. Heller. Now that we have welcomed our two debaters, I will remind you that this is a civil debate. What does that mean? Well, civil debate is intended to serve as a platform to allow intellectually respectable opinions, each with their own unique merit, to be shared in a public forum. To quote the London and New York City-based debate program, Intelligence Squared, quote, debate challenges our own lack of objectivity where our minds have been contaminated by conviction, end quote. And if you haven't figured it out yet, debate is also competition. So by the time the debate has ended, we will have one side winning and one side losing. And that is determined by the votes of you. So now on to round one, opening statements by each debater in turn. They will be 7 minutes each maximum. After the opening statements, I will ask a few questions to our speakers for which they will each have 30 seconds to respond. Speaking first for the motion, the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system, is Dr. Paul Sung.
Thank you so much for allowing us to come to speak, and it was really great to get to meet Dr. Heller. As we mentioned, it's going to be very respectful. He has a son that went to the University of Chicago, which is my alma mater, and he's from New Jersey, where I grew up. So right off the bat, I think we are going to have more in common than not. Having said that, it's hard to believe, but over 20 years ago, when I was in my last year of medical school, the Surgeon General at that time was C. Everett Koop, and at our graduation, he asked myself and all of our graduating seniors to raise our hand and repeat the Hippocratic Oath. And in that Hippocratic Oath, there was one part that still resonates to me this day and a few years when you recite the oath. I hope you'll remember these verses. It says, I will follow that system of regimen which, according to my ability and judgment, I consider for the benefit of my patients and abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous. And when I took that oath, I had no idea that in the 20 years following that the medical system that we were practicing in would become more and more deleterious and mischievous to our patients. As a cancer doc, I see many of my patients who have insurance that are going bankrupt. And what was crazy was that, believe it or not, in 2011, there were close to 2.5 million medical-related bankruptcies in the United States. And of these, 75% of all these people actually had insurance. How is that supposed to happen in our country? As you heard earlier in the introductory statements, we spend roughly 17% of our whole gross domestic product on healthcare, twice as much as any industrialized nation. And what do we get for that? We still have 51 million people in the United States who are uninsured. This is pre-ACA. And roughly 28,000 people, if you believe this study from Harvard that shows that 28,000 people in the United States die each year strictly because they're uninsured. I don't consider that to be pro-life for all of the politicians that expound that. So one of the things that I did, and I would ask each and every one of you to do, is what is wrong with our system? And not to take my word for it or to Dr. Heller's word for it, but to look at the data very much like if you were trying to arrive at the best treatment for your patients. What is the published literature, and what are the examples of healthcare systems in our country and in our world that really work? And from that, I concluded that single-payer healthcare was by far the way to go. But before I discuss a little bit of single-payer, I just want to mention a few things about the Affordable Care Act. So prior to the Affordable Care Act, it should be noted that since 2002, the top private insurance industries have raised premiums 185% since 2002. So over the last 12 years, 185%. Meanwhile, during this whole time, median wages have only increased 10%, and inflation has only gone up 33%. Meanwhile, profits for the largest for-profit insurers have grown steadily, and CEO salaries of the major insurance companies are now 400 times what the average worker makes. And what do they do with this money? Well, up to the run-up of the Affordable Care Act, there were 3,300 registered healthcare lobbyists for the 535 members of Congress. That's roughly six lobbyists from one member of Congress, and they spent $1.2 million a day, more than what was spent on the Bush-Kerry election, to influence the legislation. And that's why the Affordable Care Act is not so much socialized medicine as it is corporate welfare. It's a big gift to the private insurance industry. And one of the things that should be noted is it does do some good things. Obviously, now up to 30 million Americans will have access to care. But it's estimated by 2022, 32 million Americans will still not have health care. And when people say Republicans, Democrats can't get along or come at a consensus, that's actually not true. The one thing they could agree on with regard to the Affordable Care Act was that it would not cover undocumented people in the United States. So And trying to find what is the best treatment, what I did was I went and researched all of the literature. And when I first started this, I must say that my ideology was not nearly towards single payer. And what I found was there's really no perfect healthcare system. I'm not saying single payer is without fault, and nor is any system absolutely perfect. But when you look at the countries that have that, by and far, every single person, there were no medical-related bankruptcies, and it was by far the more cost-efficient. So how does this work? So prior to the Affordable Care Act, you have a private insurance industry that takes 31 cents of every healthcare dollar away from actual patient care. And what do they use that money for? Administrative costs, marketing, overhead, sales, billing, lobbying, and CEO compensation. As part of the ACA, they'll only be allowed to use 15 cents of every dollar towards those expenses, but it's very loose in terms of what they define as a patient cost or not. So a single-payer system would eliminate this private insurance inefficiency and recapture that administrative waste. It's estimated to be roughly $476 billion annually that is not actually used for patient care. Now, when you look at the entire Affordable Care Act, it was, what, 800-something billion over 10 years. We're talking that we could save more than half of that annually, and with that money, not only could we insure every single person in the United States, we could make everyone's benefits much better and elevate the overall quality of care that we have. And we have a single-payer system in the United States. It's called Medicare. Medicare was launched in 1965 when 56% of adults were insured and one-third of seniors were living in poverty. And contrary to what people say, the Commonwealth Fund has shown that Medicare recipients have far greater satisfaction than those in the private insurance industry, and they've been able to keep costs down. Premiums for private insurance have risen 6.5% annually, where it's only been 4% for Medicare. And the final thing is Medicare is much more administratively efficient. If you look at a study by Kip Sullivan from the University of Minnesota, which I passed on, and anything that I recite today, I already provided the literature. The true administrative costs are 1.4 to 1.6% for Medicare, where it's roughly 12% for the private insurance industry. So I just want to start that as an opening statement that we're already putting more than enough money into the system. If we remove a for-profit, non-ethical entity that only makes money by denying care to patients, pull them out of the system and use that money for actual patient care, I think we'll do just fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Song. Now we turn it over to Dr. Heller to argue against the motion.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for inviting me here. Yes, I'm going to argue against the motion that the U.S. should switch to single payer. And although there are a lot of reasons to make such an argument, I'm going to emphasize three. One is that Medicare for all cannot work because Medicare for a few doesn't work. The second broad reason is that single payer is based on a wrong diagnosis of the problem, and in fact is really a solution that is doing more of the same that caused the problem in the first place. And finally, I'm going to argue that single payer simply cannot be implemented in the U.S. So, Medicare for all cannot work. Frederick Bastiat, the 19th century French economist and political philosopher, said, "The state is that great fiction by which everyone tries to live at the expense of everyone else." Margaret Thatcher said it a little more succinctly, "Eventually, you run out of other people's money." What I mean by cannot work is that the inputs aren't sufficient for the outputs. You can't consume what you don't produce. If someone doesn't grow the wheat, grind it into flour, bake it into bread, you can't eat a sandwich. Medicare currently covers just 16% of the population. It spends about $574 billion, that's 2012, and collects just $323 billion. That is, Medicare runs at an annual deficit year in and year out that exceeds $250 billion. That's just covering 16% of the population. Now, Dr. Song has told us that there's an extra $400 billion laying around for Medicare for all. Is that enough to make single payer work? One necessary step is for Medicaid beneficiaries to become Medicare for all beneficiaries. Medicaid pays 66% of Medicare rates. 33% of the $431 billion paid by Medicaid is $142 billion. States pay 36% of Medicaid. 36% of that $431 billion is $155 billion. Converting Medicaid to Medicare for all will cost $297 billion annually. Except for Medicaid, Medicare is the lowest payer for services. Medicaid and Medicare do not pay the full cost of services. And those costs are shifted to commercial insurers. Commercial insurance pays between 110 and 140% of Medicare rates, 125%, taking the mid-range of that, of the $1.147 trillion spent by Medicare and Medicaid is an additional $275 billion. To maintain the status quo, Medicare for All will have to spend substantially more for everyone than it currently does for just 34% of the population already collecting Medicare and Medicaid. $250 billion will have to go just to get Medicare to break even for the current 16%. $142 billion will go to bring Medicaid equal to Medicare payments. $155 billion to replace the state's share of Medicaid. $275 billion will be required to bring Medicaid and Medicare rates equal to current spending, including costs shifted to commercial payers. That's $822 billion to bring Medicare and it's more than twice the $400 billion Dr. Song says we have, and that's just to pay for current Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. Medicare and Medicaid, for a few, incurs huge deficits and requires substantial cost shifting. Expanding the program to Medicare for All will likely expand the deficits and will lose the sources for cost shifting. Medicare for All is based on a wrong diagnosis of the problem. Lack of access is an economic problem and can't be solved with a political solution. Murray Rothbard, the economist and libertarian activist, said, "It is no crime to be ignorant of economics, which is, after all, a specialized discipline and one that most people consider to be a dismal science. But it is totally irresponsible to have a loud and vociferous opinion on economic subjects while remaining in the state of ignorance." Lack of access is probably better termed shortage. Shortage means that price, supply, and demand never approach equilibrium, but are maintained such that demand consistently exceeds supply. One cause of this problem is subsidy. Some people get care that is partially or fully paid for by others. Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, tax breaks for employer-sponsored health insurance, cost shifting. Widely subsidized care prevents demand from falling to meet supply. The other cause is protection from competition. Barriers to entry of competitors, licensing, insurance regulations, certificate of need laws, complex regulatory schemes. This protection from competition prevents supply from increasing to meet demand. Single-payer advocates have noted and criticized the lack of competition in the insurance market. Why are they prescribing monopoly as the cure for oligopoly? Continuing and strengthening the regime of subsidy and suppression of competition will continue and worsen the problem of shortage or lack of access. Finally, single-payer cannot be implemented in the United States. Emma Goldman, the 20th century anarchist, wrote, "If voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal." The insurance companies, hospital conglomerates, and big pharma have demonstrated that they have controlling political clout, as Dr. Song alluded. None of these entities want single payer. In particular, the insurance industry will not permit itself to be legislated out of existence. Unions will resist giving up their health and welfare funds to pay for single payer insurance for their members. States can and will resist turning over their share of Medicaid spending to pay for single payer. Those who pay premiums for commercial insurance will be resistant to converting those premiums to taxes. They will expect a better plan to be a cheaper plan than their current premiums. That is, they'll expect to pay less in taxes for single payer than what they are currently paying for commercial insurance. Dr. Song's plan unrealistically contemplates total payments to remain the same. In short, everyone will favor spending and no one will agree to pay for it. Congress has a long and proven track record of spending freely and taxing inadequately. This is exactly the problem that got us where we are, and single payer is more of the same. There is no reason to expect any different result. Single payer is based on a misdiagnosis of the problem that causes lack of access. Single payer cannot work. Single payer cannot be implemented in the U.S. Single payer is an attempt to do more of the same while expecting a different result. That is not a rational solution to any problem.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Heller. I will now ask each of you some questions. The person I ask the question to responds first, and the other person will have the opportunity to respond as well, but your responses are limited to 30 seconds. So let's start with Dr. Heller. Dr. Song mentioned that he sees many patients go bankrupt, even with healthcare insurance, due to the high cost of their medical treatment for cancer. How do you suggest this country is going to manage the skyrocketing costs of healthcare, even among those who are insured?
You say bankruptcy like it's a bad thing. Bankruptcy means that the patient got their healthcare at someone else's expense and then was excused from paying back. Bankruptcy is not a great thing, but compared to the alternative, it's not that bad. You know, pointing to bankruptcies is really not the problem. The problem is that if you consume health care, it has to be paid for. It has to be produced.
Okay. Dr. Song?
Well, so along those lines, I would just say with regard to bankruptcy, I was talking about people that paid for insurance, that they had a contract. They paid for an actual provision to take care of them at the time of illness. We should not allow these companies that are making record profits to be able to pinch patients that are paying for something for a contract. Well, that was my point. I'm not talking about those that don't have insurance. I'm talking about those patients out of the, you know, 2.5 million people that went medically related bankruptcies. 75% of them actually had insurance.
Well,
are you defending that system?
Okay. Dr. Song, how do you respond to hospitals and physicians who are unhappy with their Medicare reimbursement and the potential limitations they feel that places on their practice?
So I will just say that at least in California, that's not entirely true that Medicare is the lowest reimbursement. A lot of the HMOs actually pay less than Medicare, and that's going to become the trend nationally. And doctors need to be aware of that's one. Second thing I would say is if when you simplify administrative costs, when my office has to deal with 5 or 10 different providers getting authorization, with one single payer system, an average doctor's office is expected to save $70,000 a year in administrative costs.
Okay. Would you like to respond, Dr. Heller?
Well, yeah, but the actual fact is that overall insurers do get costs from Medicare and Medicaid shifted to them. Medicare and Medicaid do not pay the full cost of care, even though there may be places where HMOs are empowered, like California, where they don't take those cost shifts.
I'd like to follow up on what you just said, which is that costs are shifted to commercial insurers. So what is your vision for what commercial insurers are supposed to do to manage that increased financial burden and still be able to provide to the people that they insure?
I'm sure I don't understand the question.
So if the cost is shifted to commercial insurers, what is their obligation to the people that they insure?
Well, it's a hidden tax, essentially. The cost shifting is a hidden tax on people who are paying premiums for health insurance. They're paying for their own health insurance costs plus the cost of government beneficiaries.
Would you like to respond?
Yes. So I would actually say that the majority of the reason our premiums are higher or hospitals raise costs are not so much because of their Medicare reimbursements, which are actually pretty reliable and at least steady. It's due to the massive uninsured population that we have here in our country.
Okay. For Dr. Song, you mentioned some other countries who use the single payer model. What country, can you provide a specific example of a country that uses a single payer model that is the most applicable for the U.S. population?
Actually, one of the things I'd like to say is that there's always this term of economic freedom, and the Cato Institute publishes their list of the economic freedom index. And what's interesting, of every country, there's at least 8 or 9 countries that are listed ahead of the United States in terms of economic freedom. All of them have a government-run healthcare system. Margaret Thatcher, as much as she was a big proponent of the National Health Service. But if you want to look, the best example, Hong Kong has Ricardian free trade, freest economy in the world, low levels of regulation, no capital gains, individual flat tax, and it's rated number one in the Heritage Foundation Index of Economic Freedom. It healthcare costs 3% of GDP, and it has a single payer system.
Dr. Heller, would you like to respond to the Hong Kong?
There are actually very few countries that have single payer systems, except for perhaps Canada. Every country that has a so-called single payer system has a safety valve where people can escape that system and obtain medical care that they want and are willing to pay for. And Canada, with something like 90% of its population is within 50 miles of a U.S. doctor, that's their safety valve. So, and with regard to other countries, they have strange ideas about other things too, particularly things like freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Doesn't mean we should adopt their practices simply because they have single payer.
Would you like to respond to that?
Just to say that there have been studies looking at the emigre of patients coming to Canada, and it's actually minuscule. And if anything, there are actually more U.S.-trained doctors who were born in the United States who have now chosen to practice in Canada than in the United States. If you look at the emigration of doctors from the United States to Canada, it's actually gone up. And why? Because it's much easier to practice there. The actual salaries for the average physician in Canada are higher than they are now in the United States. Malpractice costs are minimal, and overall paperwork is minimal as well.
Okay, one more question. Dr. Song, in this Medicare-like system, do you envision that the government would be in charge of overseeing that system? And given the bumpy rollout of the Affordable Care Act, do you think the government is capable of overseeing a single-payer system in the United States?
While that is obviously waits to be seen, I can tell you that at least in a state like California, where there was it's been lauded as a model of the exchange, that's what happens when you've got cooperation from a then Republican governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, and a Democratic legislature. The ACA, for what you may believe, was a Republican idea, originally started by Richard Nixon, touted by the Heritage Foundation, put into place by Governor Romney. And just because President Obama put it into place, it's viewed as a socialized system. But in where you have cooperation, it's done well. The problem is in all the other states, you had a Republican governor or legislature that actually not only obstructed it, but they did their best to defeat it.
Okay. Would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think two words will suffice. Post office.
Okay. And that concludes round one of tonight's great debate. At this time, we will take a short break and allow our debaters to prepare for the next round of the debate while I'll explain the next portion of our programming this evening. As a reminder, or for those of you tuning in just now, you are currently listening to The Great Debate. Tonight's motion, the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. Tonight's debate is brought to you by medical students at Albany Medical College and WAMC Northeast Public Radio. I'm Dr. Kim Kilby, your moderator for the evening. We have two debaters. Dr. Paul Song is arguing for the motion, and Dr. Mitchell Heller is arguing against the motion. And now we go on to round two, where the debaters take questions from our live audience. As our audience members prepare their questions, I have some questions that were submitted to me in advance from students and physicians. The first question is, Dr. Song, how would a single-payer system be financed, and how long will it take before it is less expensive than what we have now? And this was submitted by a medical student.
So there are several ways. There was a recent publication by Dr. Gerald Friedman, who is an economist at the University of Massachusetts. And the way this would be proposed would be a graduated tax. Now, the idea is that if you free up businesses and you decouple employee benefit health care and from actual benefits or salary, that generally wages will increase. And with that extra amount of money, you can then spend money to go purchase health care. The difference is that this is a real system where every single premium that is spent is actually used for patient care and not to pad some salary or for extensive marketing overhead.
Dr. Heller, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I mean, this goes to this whole magic of government efficiency. I don't know anybody who really thinks that government efficiency is anything other than an oxymoronic statement. In fact, the CMS currently contracts out most of its administration of Medicare to private insurance companies. There's really no magic here involved. It's accounting trickery.
Can I just comment on that?
Sure.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. So what you said was actually true, and that points to me the inefficiency between the private sector and the way the government is run. So in 1995, then the GOP had pledged that if they placed more and more Medicare beneficiaries into Medicare HMOs, that it would bring costs down $700 billion over 7 years, $270 billion over 7 years. Instead, it increased the cost $282 billion, and in 2012 alone had $34 billion more in overpayments. So there has been absolutely no proof that when it comes to Medicare beneficiaries, the private sector has done a better job than the government has.
Question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Paul Sorum. I'm a primary care physician in internal medicine and pediatrics. And I wanted to ask you, from the point of view of a practicing physician, both of you practice medicine, and really sort of thinking in terms of both of you respond to the idea of the simplicity or the ease of practicing medicine under, on the one hand, a single-payer system, and on the other hand, a system like now. What would you prefer in terms of making it simpler for you to actually do what you'd like to do, which is to take care of patients?
Well, you know, it's sort of a false choice because, in my view, single payer is not that different and maybe even be a strengthening and expansion of the current system where you're responsible to bureaucrats who are trying to use bureaucratic methods to prevent you from getting paid, and therefore you have to expend a great deal of effort in overhead kinds of situations. The real comparison is between a bureaucratic system and a market system.
Dr.
So one of the things we always hear is that we should not let the government become between us and our patients. But if anything, my office is fighting with insurance companies daily, trying to get approval to do what tests they want to do, what treatment they want to give, what drug they want to prescribe. If you're a patient, they want to tell you what hospital to go to, what provider to see. If we have one single person that we know, this is the set fee, this is the set benefit, my office doesn't have to spend all that time, nor do I have to write letters of rationalization for a treatment that the medical literature supports.
Great. While the next person from the audience is coming forward, I'll ask you another question. So, Dr. Heller, wouldn't a free healthcare market continue to incentivize medical students to enter subspecialty practices because the reimbursements are higher rather than the lower paid primary care fields?
I'm not sure why you think that. Reimbursement is based on demand in a free market system, and if the patients need primary care, that's where the incentives will be to practice.
Dr. Song, would you like to respond?
Well, that I think is a problem, and as a specialist, I plead guilty. But I will say that one of the other problems we talk about the insurance industry is our fee-for-service method as well, where you get paid per procedure or per patient rather than, you know, the outcome. And I think that's one of the things, again, that the single-payer system is trying to do.
Well, in a market system, you might have that kind of reimbursement. There's nothing that says that a market would be free fee-for-service. It could be fee per hour. It could be outcome-based. The market would discover the most desirable and efficient way to provide services.
I just want to say, though, that there is no such thing as a free market in our healthcare system.
Well, of course not. It's heavily regulated and government-run.
Well, but not only that. Do you know there are only two industries that are exempt from antitrust legislation, Major League Baseball and the private insurance industry? Also, I would also point out that in most cities, most metropolitan areas, 94 top metropolitan areas, over one or two insurers generally covers the majority of the people. 50% of the entire insurable population in the United States is covered by United Health Group. So for a physician standpoint, if we're trying to negotiate rates for payment against this behemoth, I don't see how you can say that we're better off than with Medicare.
Well, again, as I said, I don't understand how monopoly is the solution to oligopoly.
All right, so let's move on to another question from the audience. Please step up to the microphone.
Hi, I'm Andrew Kai. I'm a second-year medical student at Albany Med. This question is for Dr. Song. You mentioned in California that the HMO reimbursement rates are actually lower than Medicare rates reimbursements. Why? And then you also mentioned that you feel like this trend is going to spread nationally. Could you elaborate on that?
So this gets back to one part of our market becoming so powerful. So in the 70s and 80s, the healthcare system was very fraught with waste, and not just administrative waste, but doctors overprescribing hospital. And so HMOs came together. The idea was to bring down costs, be much more stringent on tests and things, and they successfully trimmed all the fat from that. But now, once you've trimmed all the fat, there's nothing to trim but bone. And how do you do that? So you cut meaningful treatments and benefits for patients. What's happened is they've consolidated so much that Kaiser insures up to, you know, a huge percentage of our population. So they set one rate, and all of the insurers, Blue Cross Blue Shield, dominate the space. So they come to doctors and they say, I'm only going to pay you this. No more, no less. And you have no choice because they have such a huge percentage of the population of patients. And as a result, in order to get the contracts, they've made doctors take less and less and less. And you're seeing more and more doctors getting paid less than Medicare.
And that is completely an environment that's manufactured by government. The empowerment of insurance companies, the protection from competition, the regulation, the barriers to entry, all of those bring about the result that Dr. Song decries. And again, single payer is simply going to magnify and emphasize that same practice.
Thank you. We have another question from the audience.
Good evening. My name is Brian Cherry. I'm a clinical veterinarian in the area, and what I wanted to ask you both about is cost containment, and nobody knows anything more about medical care cost containment than the veterinary community, because that is what we have to live with every day. And I'm wondering whether it's a single-payer system, whether it's a free market or a pseudo-free market system with insurers, how do either of these systems go about containing costs, which seems to be the biggest problem, whether it's driven by insurers driving up that alone or other factors? Cost containment seems to be a major problem, and how are these systems going to address
that? Why are your costs contained?
Well, indeed, our costs are contained because it has to come out of someone's pocket. So whether it's the insurance companies that have to pay or whether it's a single payer that has to pay, someone's going to have to put constraints. If we don't constrain the costs, they're still going to increase.
But in a market, the customer constrains their own costs. Who better to constrain their costs than the person who's paying? When you have someone else paying, when you're paying with someone else's money, everything's on the table.
The way that costs get contained in veterinary medicine is medicine is not delivered.
That's true, and people will have to make choices. Economics is all about scarcity. Scarcity is the human condition. You can't have everything all the time for everyone.
And I think that illustrates, we recognize the same problems, but we come from a different perspective. I come from a perspective that I believe our society is defined by how we take care of the weakest among us, and collectively we're better off for it. The problem with cost containment with the Affordable Care Act was the insurance lobby was so powerful that they did not allow the insurance industry to be regulated. So they can set their prices year after year after year. And the problem I see with cost containment, like if you don't give care, that your animals die. Same thing, when patients are forced to pay high copays or things or have these HSAs, so they're supposed to take personal responsibility, many of them will delay getting care because it's between paying for this or paying the rent. And as a result, that's not the type of society I believe we're too good of a society to just allow patients to do that. That's my opinion.
Yes, but what happens is that paying for dialysis for the demented woman in the nursing home who's already trached and pegged is going to deprive children of vaccinations. There is fixed amount of resources in the system. Single payer doesn't solve that problem. It simply shifts resources to politically powerful groups and away from people who need care as well.
Well, along those lines, so you mentioned Medicare only taking care of 16% of our population. They also happen to be the generally the sickest, oldest population. They make it easy for the private insurance industry. They only cover private insurance. You only have to cover until 65, and after that, when they've got multiple medical conditions and chronic conditions, we'll pick that up. If we allowed 23-year-olds, 26-year-olds to buy into the pool and spread out the risk, we would strengthen Medicare. We would make it much more viable, and the difference between the market and Medicare is Medicare is not trying to stiff patients so they can go pad somebody's exorbitant salary. They're trying to keep it so that it remains solvent so they can take care of more people. Big different motive in terms of why they're cutting costs.
You're really talking about subsidy. You're asking young people to subsidize older people.
I think we should move on to another question because we've got several from the audience.
Hi, my name is Vincent Camisso. I'm an adjunct instructor at SUNY Albany and grad student. My question sort of is in response to something Dr. Heller said, which was that Canada is the only example of a single-payer system, although I'm curious of whether or not there's other systems, albeit state systems, particularly those in Scandinavian countries and whatnot, that are run by the state, and what the differences between a single-payer system and one of those are, and why a single-payer would be preferable to those or not. Thanks.
So the difference is, a single-payer system is where the government owns and operates just the insurance industry, the aspect. They are the third-party administrator. The other systems that you talk about, Denmark, Great Britain, are socialized medicine, where the government owns the hospitals, it employs the doctors, it employs the pharmacists, it employs the radiologists, it owns the radiology equipment, it owns the cafeteria, it owns and operates every single aspect of the system. No one's ever, so that social, we have that system, it's called the VA system. What we're looking at is just removing the for-profit insurance administrator from the equation and replacing it with a administrator that will make sure that every dollar is actually spent on patient care.
Would you like to respond?
No.
Okay.
Just
why is a single payer preferable to a socialized medical, an actually socialized medical system? That's, I guess, the thrust of my question.
So that is a good question, and people have looked at that. I think that the idea, you heard what socialism elicited during the whole ACA debate. That was something. And, you know, that would be every single doctor in the United States would work for the government. Every hospital would be owned by the government. Every pharmacy, there would be no more CVS. They'd be owned, again, by the government. I think that would be really much, much more of a stretch to do. I will just say this. Dr. Hell is absolutely right. His third point was dead on about the political appetite, the power of the insurance industry, and things of that nature. That's why we have to do what we're trying to do like they did in Canada, where it started in a small province, Saskatchewan, and then spread concurrently. So you're seeing Vermont going through this right now, trying to pass it. And if we can start there and eventually get California and other places, then you'll see it follow. Kind of like what's happening with gay marriage.
I'd just add that I think Dr. Song is making what my wife, the attorney, would call a distinction without a difference. Single payer, basically he who pays the piper calls the tune, and whether the hospitals and the practices are formally owned by the government or simply controlled by controlling the purse strings, is of little moment.
Can I just say one?
Sure.
So why is it when large insurers negotiate with providers and pharmaceutical companies, it's considered free market, but when the government tries to do that, it's considered unfair?
I didn't say it was free market. I said it was oligopoly enforced by government regulation and messing with the market.
Let's go to another question from our audience.
Good evening. My name is Bennett McEwen. I run a consulting company here in Albany, New York, that works on Medicaid and health insurance exchange projects. My question has to do with price transparency. So one of the requirements of a free market system is price transparency. Without that price transparency, the free market system can't work. The New York Times recently published a report that showed the price of a simple operation could vary from as much as $1,000 to $85,000. How do we get close, if we want a free market system, how do we get price transparency in America? Thank you.
Well, price transparency comes about when somebody walks in and has to pay out of pocket. It's part and parcel of a market system where I offer a service and you say how much and I tell you. The only reason there's no price transparency in the current system is because it's a third-party payer system. The patient doesn't pay. So the patient comes in and orders all the filet mignon they can eat and doesn't care about the price.
Dr. Song?
Having just been, my good friend just had triplets and ran into this at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, and they charged him $1 million for his NICU, and he tried to find out what the other insurers were paying, and they wouldn't give it to him. That is a problem. The problem with transparency or negotiating prices is if you have a ruptured appendix, or if I show up in your ER, I can't negotiate a price when I'm having an acute MI. I can't say, well, this is the price I want. For elective, and then if I have a rare condition, I can't get enough people to negotiate the price down with me. So I think the idea of allowing individuals to set those prices, it doesn't work unless it's maybe elective surgery and you're going to go get collagen in your lip and shop around. But when you have an acute condition, you can't negotiate prices.
Well, but that's a mischaracterization of how markets set prices. People don't negotiate prices. Prices are set by supply and demand in a market, and that's a very very automatic process. Nobody negotiates prices, and very little medical care is emergent care. And even then, people will in the community will know what an emergency room costs, and if one emergency department is charging a great deal more than another, they will avoid it.
So if you have a son that has a rare genetic condition that maybe only affects 1 out of 10,000 people, and without some very expensive treatment, that patient's going to die and you can't afford it, are you saying as a free market, no interference person, tough luck? Is that really the society that you want to be part of?
That's the proper role for insurance, is rare and disastrous occurrences. And people can certainly insure against rare and disastrous occurrences, just as they insure against fires and automobile crashes.
But you know the way the insurance industry operates, if you don't spell out exactly what's covered in the beginning, and you, just growing up, you don't think your kid is ever going to have this rare type of, you know, whatever, cancer or whatever, you don't put that in.
Prudent, I can't help you. The opportunities are there to be prudent and to be careful with your resources.
All right, let's move on. Next question from the audience.
I'm Dave Sorkin, I'm a medical student, and I have another question for Dr. Heller. You know, the system that we have right now is not performing the way we want, not getting the outcomes that we want. And so here and on a national scale, this debate about single payer is permeated or maybe corrupted by the sentiment that, you know, well, we have to try something. We can't just keep going. So are there other options that we can consider? And could you talk briefly about those?
Well, yeah, I think I've been implying those, that we have a system that is the most efficient known for supplying the goods and services that people need. It's called voluntary cooperation. It's a market. A market is really just the aggregate of people exchanging goods and services voluntarily. And that supplies housing and clothing and shoes and shelter and food seamlessly and efficiently. There's no reason to think that the same couldn't be done for healthcare if government permitted it to happen.
Let's move on to the next question, and this will be our last question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Alice Brody, okay? And if we're going to look at statistics, data, in terms of where the United States is in relationship to all the other industrialized countries, on many of the indicators, we're way at the bottom, 37th in the world in terms of infant mortality is just one example. We're also the most expensive system in the world. I think it's about $18,000 per capita, whereas the other countries are much, much lower. Not every system is like Canada. A country like Germany and Switzerland, they do have some segment of the system who are insurers, but it's regulated. It's regulated. Everything is basically transparent. So my question is, how do you respond to the fact that we have some of the worst outcomes, we're the most expensive in the world, and we have millions of people who have no access to medical care?
Well, I think we've been discussing that overall. The outcome measurements are false. Life expectancy measurements are influenced by the way that we count infant mortality in this country, which is where we include a great many more live births than other countries, and because of automobile accidents and violent death in the U.S. among young people. So the statistics that show poor infant mortality and life expectancy are really not true.
I agree with you. And with regard to Canada, I would say that a lot of people, and I know a lot of Canadians, and they'll tell you it's not perfect, but they can always get care. Now, they may have to wait if it's not elective for like hip replacements and things like that. But I will tell you that in the United States, the majority of patients who get hip replacements are Medicare, and there is no wait time. So that is not true. The idea would be that we would have still a private sector that could handle supplemental insurance, or if you didn't like to wait for the treatment that you were going to get for free, you could then go and get it in a more timely manner. But life-threatening treatments, you can get just to the similar wait times as you can in the United States.
All right, thank you. That concludes round two of this great debate, where our motion is the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. So we're going to have you in the audience vote shortly, but before that, we're going to have closing statements and then you'll be voting. So on to round three, closing statements by each debater in turn. They will be 2 minutes each, and here to summarize his position against the motion the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system is Dr. Mitchell Heller.
Adam Smith, in his lesser-known book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, wrote, "The man of system is apt to be very wise in his own conceit, and is often so enamored with the supposed beauty of his own ideal plan of government that he cannot suffer the smallest deviation from any part of it. He goes on to establish it completely and in all its parts, without any regard either to the great interests or to the strong prejudices which may oppose it. He seems to imagine that he can arrange the different members of a great society with as much ease as the hand arranges the different pieces upon a chessboard. He does not consider that the pieces upon the chessboard have no other principle of motion besides that which the hand impresses upon them, but that, in the great chessboard of human society, every single piece has a principle of motion of its own. If those two principles coincide and act in the same direction, the game of human society will go on easily and harmoniously. If they are opposite or different, the game will go miserably." Smith wrote that about 250 years ago. We stand on the shoulders of giants, yet some of us insist on reinventing the square wheel. Of course, it is impossible that the principles of motion chosen by a man of system and those chosen by the individuals in a society coincide and act in the same direction. Thus, any such game must go on miserably. In this age of crowdsourcing, wikis, social networks, and cryptocurrencies, of cloud computing and open source applications, of Uber and Airbnb, and at the dawn of home manufacturing by 3D printers, it's hard to understand how command and control models like single payer still gain intellectual traction at all. Suppression of competition, subsidy of politically favored groups, bureaucratic allocation of resources is what has brought us where we are today, a situation where large numbers of Americans cannot afford a basic necessity. Single-payer embraces and amplifies every one of those causative features. It eliminates competition, universalizes subsidy, and completely replaces supply, demand, and prices with bureaucratic resource allocation. It is said that doing more of the same and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. How then can any rational person endorse the proposition switch to single-payer?
All right. Thank you, Dr. Heller. Our motion is the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system, and here to summarize his position in support of this motion, Dr. Paul Song.
So I've already made the moral argument that we as a society are defined by, I think, how we take care of the least among us, and I think that there's no shame in believing that. But I want to make an economic argument why. Prior to the bailout, GM spent more on healthcare than it did on steel. Healthcare costs have been a continuous drag on the American competitiveness, and every major trading partner of the United States has an organized government-run healthcare system. Individuals, if you want to talk about real freedom, individuals would no longer have to stay in jobs that they did not like strictly to maintain their healthcare benefits. Business CEOs would love to have health insurance costs removed from their books, which would allow them to have more money to spend on capital investment, to increase R&D, and to pay higher wages. And all governors would certainly love to have Medicaid removed from their books. Even strong capitalists like Margaret Thatcher and Winston Churchill supported a national health service. And as Dr. Heller mentioned, Adam Smith, I want to mention someone else from 250 years ago, Thomas Jefferson, who said that we have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and protecting these rights is the function of government. So when we have too many people in our society dying of illness that medical science already has long had a cure for, or going bankrupt simply because health insurance is inadequate or too expensive, or treatment without insurance simply costs too much, the government should step in and protect our right to life. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Song. And that concludes our closing statements. And now it's time to learn which side you feel has argued best. Please vote for, against, or undecided on the motion. I want to congratulate Dr. Song and Dr. Heller for bringing the true and respectful spirit of civil discourse tonight to this debate. Please give them a round of applause. I would also like to thank the people at the Linda and WAMC Northeast Public Radio for hosting and producing this debate. It takes the support of great media organizations like WAMC to make programming like tonight's debate accessible to all. Please consider becoming a member of your local public radio station to support future programming like this. I also want to congratulate Victoria Chi, Justin Pigueros, Sheen Guan, Madeline Haas, AJ Major, Nancy Lin, and Daniel Kent, the medical students at Albany Medical College who organized tonight's program. And most of all, thank you to the audience members and those of you listening on the radio or internet for tuning in. Our motion is this: the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. We've had you vote before the debate, and you just voted a second time after hearing the arguments on this very motion. And remember, the team whose numbers have changed the most in your judgment will be declared our winner. So the initial vote on the motion, the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. So before the debate, 66% of the audience was for the motion, 5% was against the motion, and 29% were undecided. After the debate, 80% were for the motion, 2% were against the motion, and 18% were undecided. So the biggest difference was for Dr. Song for the motion, the United States should switch to a single-payer healthcare system. He has triumphed in this debate. Our congratulations to Dr. Song. So thank you to both Dr. Song and Dr. Heller. Thank you from me, Dr. Kim Kilby, and thanks again to WAMC Northeast Public Radio for providing the venue and the airwaves to host such an incredibly great debate.